First of all, I'm going to point out that the definition of the word yoga is practically synonymous with the English word yoke. And you know that the languages that we use in Europe, the English language, the Germanic languages, and the various other languages in Europe, are connected with the Indo-Aryan languages of the remote past, of which probably Sanskrit is a type language. It is here where we find that the word yoga is exactly the same word in its root form from which our word yoke comes from. And then we see a rather funny thing, how it changes its form literally in the way it is written, and then becomes another word that we normally do not associate with yoga. If we write this word yoga down like this, most of you would say that this letter where I fill the third place where you would expect to find a hard G doesn't look very much like a G. But if we write it the other way up and then close the top and add a decorative tail, then we can see that quite easily this could be the same letter. This is to do with the primary symbols used by the human race from the most remote antiquity being developed in certain specific ways for purposes of government. One of the essentials of government is that there must be a centre from which orders are sent forth. There must be an authority for an act to maintain the unity of state. And as the human race spread out, that is to say, as people began to multiply by reproduction, families became too big to stay in one place. The food scarcity caused them to move about in search of other pastures for their sheep and cattle, and in search of foods and shelters, more pleasant places to live. And as families became too big to stay in one place, they split. And after the family, we developed the tribe, and after this, by similar methods of multiplication, the nation, and so on. But wherever they went, the father of a given family would like his own children to do as he said, rather than what his brother, who lived a few miles up the road, wished them to do. And so gradually, private terminologies were built up by the heads of tribes and of nations. And although the original significance of terms was known to the original family from which the human race derives, as it passed through different terrains, it modified its vocabulary and frequently deliberately inverted a word so that the district from which it had moved would no longer understand what it was saying. You can easily understand that if you find out that there is a very good bit of pasture for your sheep, in the terms of brotherly love, you won't mention it to him. You will go out quietly and put a fence round it and decide to keep it. And it is through consideration of this fact that the French thinkers have said the major purpose of language is to divert thought. If somebody says to you, "Where did you get that gold brick from?" you say, "It fell out of a cloud during a rainstorm." Not, "I found it at the bottom of the garden, there are 35 others of the same type there." And so diversity of language arose out of the need to conserve, to preserve life. And yet the fundamental forms of language were the same. And they could not be otherwise, because all human beings have the same mechanism of vocalization. They all use lungs for blowing air out, and they all have a larynx with certain little tissues in it for making little noises, and they have lots of holes in their head for amplification. And they have to deal with this rudimentary mechanism and ring the changes on its possibilities in order to deceive each other. Now, when we look at the word yoga, we can see it. If we write the letter Y and then the O and the G capital, as we would put it, we recognize the word. But if we were to write this word in a slightly different way, as it has been written in the past, we can see here, if we turn the Y upside down, in that way, we have written a Greek letter L. Our own version of this would be to start it on the top, go down, and loop it, and over, so that we would do this kind of L, called cursive, because anybody using it is under the curse. Now, if this is a letter L, and the inversion of it was the Greek letter gamma, the G, we can see that already we have here a Y that is an L, turned upside down, a Y, the so-called right way up for English people, this is really a hard G, and we could read it, yog, put an O in it, to make it vocalizable, and another vowel then, because we can't stop talking too suddenly, because it's got a bit of breath left, so instead of saying yog, we tend to say yoga. Ideally, you ought to say yeah, without a vowel, which is terribly difficult, and a hard G like a gamma without a vowel, which sounds something like this. It's very difficult to hear, so the ancients decided they would use a vowel to help people get the message. So they go, ga. And it's the effort on the A, R sound, that you call the hard G. Anyhow, to stop joking about this, this word yoga is exactly the same word as the lig in ligature and the lig in religio, which is religion. Religion is a quite legitimate translation of the word yoga. Religion is supposed to mean to tie back to the source of being, the infinite Godhead, the source of all being, is something we have all forgotten by coming into existence. And through forgetting that we belong to the infinite, we function as finites, and when we function as finites, we tend to fight about finite benefits. And religion is an attempt to stop fighting finitely and return to the relation that was ours in the infinite. And this process of return to the infinite was called yoga or lig, binding back, renig. So when we talk about yoga, we must think that this is not a mysterious oriental word to be engraved on the bridge of the nose or the navel with legs crossed and contemplated as a mystery of the Orient. It is exactly the same word that we find in lig, ligature, the relig in religion. So when we say yoga, we can think about religion. But we must restrict both religion and yoga to the process whereby the finite, the limited, is carried back to the infinite, the unlimited. Everybody suffers from limitation of some order or other. Everybody dislikes the limitation they suffer from. Everybody is pursuing a method of eliminating this finiting process and thus expanding in power, having life more abundantly, as the prophet says. Now, this process is either religion or yoga. So we are not to think that yoga is something peculiarly oriental and that religion is something peculiarly occidental, because fundamentally both refer to the same thing. Now, having said that, we're going to examine the philosophical basis in India of yoga practice. Because when you have a practice, by the definition of the word practice, which has the idea in it of rational activity, that is to act in a certain formal manner for a specifically designed fruit, to do something with an eye on the end result, is practice. We practice, we rationally act in order to get certain benefits. Practice means rational activity directed towards some end. Whenever we have a practice that is a rational act, we must have a rationale behind this act whereby we can make quite sure that we are taking the necessary steps. Now, a yogi is a man who is busy trying to join himself with infinite power. If you read the basic handbook of yoga, the Patanjali Yoga Aphorisms, you will find that all the trainings, once laid out, pass gradually towards the consideration of powers resulting therefrom. And then once it's described all the wonderful powers you get by practicing yoga, then there is a little message that says, and of course, you must reject all these, because if you pursue power, you are finiting yourself by the aim that you have formulated in the days of your egotism. When you are being egotistic, you want power. When you are being egotistic, you want power for an ego reason, but this is the only reason that cannot be fulfilled, because the ego itself is necessarily finited, limited, privated, and therefore is the very entity that cannot succeed in fulfilling its own ambitions of power. So that when you transcend the limitation of the individuated self, you come into a non-individuated super-self which has no ambition of the egoic order. So that once this is clearly stated, of course, most people promptly give it up and go back to business or something of that order. Because if you're only going to acquire power in order to give it up, to sacrifice it, why waste the time? Now this itself is the voice of the individuated self, the ego complex. Nevertheless, we are going to discuss it in case there are any people who are quite prepared to abandon the pursuit of power whilst at the same time doing a series of exercises which, if they are done, will confer power in order to abandon it later. This is called dialectic. You first work very, very hard for something that's marvellous with a deliberate intention, when you get it, of giving it up and behaving as if you hadn't got it. And of course, like all those mysteries, as they're called in the church, there is a reason for giving it up, which we shall examine later. Now, yoga is a process, a series of rituals, if you like, that you go through whereby you eliminate progressively the limiting factors placed on yourself, and so transcend the limitations and rise to higher levels of consciousness, of feeling awareness, of volitional power and performance ability. This is the process. Until you have gone through the process and acquired these capacities, you can't give them up. So it's really an unfair thing to say to a person who hasn't yet got them, give them up. So we're talking so that all those people who want to acquire them in order to give them up will know how to go about it. Now, yoga itself hadn't got a theory, but philosophers who were yogis formulated a theory, and this theory is one of the systems of Hindu philosophy. It is the philosophy of Samkhya, and we won't bother to do much with this word, we'll just write it down. This philosophy really means how to develop from a seed or potential by control of power into the original state of the absolute. And this is the philosophy behind yoga practice. And yet a strange thing occurs, because the philosophies that are constructed in India, of which there are six, are superficially completely contradictory, but to the Hindu philosophical mind, their contradictions are not contradictions in the inherent nature of being, they are contradictions arising only from assuming specific viewpoints. So that if we say there is no God, that is a point of view. And if we say there is a God, that is another point of view. And although from the European point of view, When you say there is a God, you mean there is a God and there is not a God. And when you say there is no God, you mean there is no God, not there is a God. And that's the deficiency of European logic. Now, in Hindu thought, when you say there is no God, you directly imply the possibility of the contrary statement, there is a God. It is a point of view. If I say to you that somewhere in the jungles in Central America there is a creature that hangs upside down with three toes, looking very worried, it's got hair all over its body, except on its tail, which is short and stumpy, and looks like a piece of nude flesh coming out of his rear end. Now, if I say this, I imply also that there are some other things there that I haven't mentioned. And this is the nature of thought. It is dialectical. When you mention something, you also mention by implication some other things which you haven't mentioned. So, Samkhya says quite simply, there is no God. Now, yoga uses Samkhya philosophy as its basis and calmly says, yes, there is a God, because we have seen him. So instead of saying we disagree with Samkhya philosophy because it says there is no God, it says we thoroughly accept Samkhya philosophy because it says there is no God. We are the ones who say there is a God, and it is our point of view. Now, in Samkhya, it is stated that there are an infinite number of selves, souls, purushas, or dwellers in the cities of bodies. Whenever there is a living body, there is a sentient power, a soul. And there are an infinity of these bodies within the infinite space through which universes extend. Therefore, there are an infinity of souls. But there is no finite, super big soul, bigger than all the other souls, and ordering those souls about. Now, the concept of God in Europe is the concept that there is a being bigger than all the other beings and with absolute power to order them about. Samkhya says there is no such being. There is no being that is so big that it can order all other beings about. But there are an infinity of beings that can order something about, and these beings are souls. So in Samkhya philosophy, there are innumerable souls, and these souls can develop their powers to amazing degrees. Now, although Samkhya does not assert the existence of a God, a superior being controlling all beings, it does assert that there are plenty of gods about the universe. And it says that the proper use of that term, which we translate as God, signifies any one-time human being who has attained sufficient power to dominate some zone of the universe completely, so that he is a god for that zone. Samkhya says there are an infinity of such gods, but that those gods are only souls who have developed self-consciousness and power, feeling, will, reason, so that they can in fact control certain zones, and they are, for the other lesser beings within those zones, gods. You find Christ saying a similar thing when accused of blasphemy, saying he is God. He says, is it not written, ye are gods, plural. He quotes the rabbis that their own doctrine says, ye, that is human beings, are gods. Now, a god is simply a being with a certain amount of power to dominate a certain zone, where the other beings in that zone have less power. This is what Samkhya says. Now, yoga, not tied by European thought processes, dialectically, totally accepts that there is no God, accepts the philosophy that there is no God, accepts the philosophy that there are lots and lots of gods who were once human beings and have now attained power, and then asserts that there is a God nevertheless. And he has a very, very simple proof of this. It says, every yogi was trained by a yogi, who was trained by a yogi, who was trained by a yogi. Now, the essential thing about yoga, it is a technique of attaining freedom from limitation. But no being who is limited can see beyond his limitations, and therefore no limited being can show the way to freedom. But there is a way to freedom, and every person who has gained it was taught by somebody who had attained it. But there must have been a first free being who taught the first being who was in bondage how to get out. And this first free being is called the Mahayogi, the great yogi of the universe, the first teacher of all yogis. And this is a cosmic god. It is not an ordinary human being. It is a super being, the great yogi of the cosmos, who laid down the rules about how to become free when you are bound, and taught this technique to bound beings. So although the yogis accept a philosophy that denies a super god, they assert that nevertheless there is a super god. Now the European mind has to get used to this capacity of the Oriental mind to assert a pair of opposites simultaneously without becoming uncomfortable. We would tend as Europeans to be a little upset if a man said, I believe in God the Father Almighty and there is no other, and at the same time I believe that he's in a lot of trouble with his highly impotent creatures who disobey him and break his rules. It makes us a little uncomfortable, and in Europe and even in enlightened America, questions are raised like, if there is a God, why is there evil? If there is an omnipotent and all-powerful God, why does he allow evil to exist? This is a deficiency of the human mind as trained in the Occidental, the Western tradition, to think simultaneously as a pair of opposites. Now, as yoga has no philosophy, because it is a performance, a process of getting this removal of limitation, and as it sees that Samkhya is exactly correct about the fundamental structure of the universe, which must be known in order to practice yoga, it suddenly accepts Samkhya structure of the universe whilst asserting that having followed through the process, it knows better than to say there is no God. It asserts there is a God, the first yogi teacher. I'm going to lay out what it is that Samkhya says. And I shall try as far as possible to avoid technical terms, because all they do, in fact, if you're not careful, is trap the mind into thinking it now knows something it didn't know before by fascinating it with a new term. So wherever possible, I shall not use the Indian term. That means I will be using it all the time. And I shall confine myself to the English equivalent, of which we haven't any. So, Samkhya is concerned with the development of the absolute out of control of power, out of the inner potential of being. And it says, first of all, that there are 25 categories. And then when you count them up, there are 26. But as I said, if you want to absorb the Oriental method of thinking, you must do this. You must learn when you read the book, and it says, and there are only 25 categories and no more, and you add them up and there are 26. You mustn't be surprised. You must say, well, that's really good, because, I mean, they gave us only 25, and at the end they've given us an extra one. And we're going to enumerate these 25, and then put the 26 in, and we'll put it in somewhere in the middle, so that we don't notice. Now, the important thing is, first of all, there is a fact, an absolute fact, for all living beings that is utterly unarguable. No one can argue against it without refuting himself. And this is the fact of consciousness. Whenever a being does what he calls knowing anything whatever, if he understands the meaning of a few words, if he perceives something with his sense organs, there is something there that is called consciousness. And this consciousness cannot be argued away, because it is present in the argument, and it's the ground of the possibility of the argument. So we will have, right at the top, pure consciousness. But of course, if we write pure consciousness up there, it will be deficient in what the Hindus meant by it. So instead of writing pure consciousness, we shall start to write pure consciousness and use something different. Now, this pur at the beginning, in purusha, is a word from which we derive our word pure. So it's still pure. And the usha part also means consciousness. It means the dawn of light being. And the whole word means a city dweller, or the light that shines inside the darkness. But instead of translating purusha as pure consciousness, the scholars translate it as, quite simply, the self, or the soul. But they do not mean by this self what you mean when you say I, as an egoic being. They mean pure consciousness, which looks upon its organism as the center of reference for an infinite space. This pure consciousness has a peculiar nature in that it is a continuum. It is not made of parts. And because it is not made of parts, it cannot be taken to bits. And because not being made of parts cannot be taken to bits, it is eternal. It is not in any sense destructible, and therefore it is absolutely enduring. And therefore they have to draw a line under this one and say everything else we write we must consider to be below the line. And the line shall represent a circle that is too big for me to draw upon the paper, so I've drawn a straight line. If you imagine, we could have drawn that line curved and gone right round off the paper and back again and come up the other side. That is that line. So everything I draw below the line must be considered to be within a circle. Now, the pure consciousness itself is that inside which objects appear. Now, this is not a matter of opinion, it is a matter of fact. And there is no scientist, no psychologist, no physiologist, no person whatever who has ever seen an object of any order that has not been in his consciousness at the moment of observation. And also, when he sees an object, in seeing it, he proves that the object is smaller than his consciousness, and the consciousness transcends the thing he's looking at. So we can always say that pure consciousness is greater than, and infinitely greater than, any object that it may perceive. Now, this is absolutely essential to yoga practice later, and it is absolutely basic to the philosophical ground of yoga. That consciousness itself is infinite, it is a continuum, that means it is not made of parts. Not being made of parts, it cannot be taken apart. Not being taken apart, it is not corruptible. Not being corruptible, it is eternal. So that the purusha, the supreme self, is pure consciousness, internal to which all objects exist, and which, when it is looking at those objects, is called the observer, the server of the object. When it is not looking at the object, but is looking at itself, it is in its absolutely free self-awareness. But when it looks at an object, it is conditioned by the form of the object. Now, the supreme object of pure consciousness had to have a term. And the root for representing finite was a root based on the root Kra, K-R-A, which you will observe is arc backwards. And this root Kra, therefore, we find in the supreme object of consciousness. And again, we will put a PR there, because this is the same PR in the poor, only now it is becoming activated. And to represent the line that goes round it, we put the root in that means draw an arc. Only because it is going to have a centre around which this circle is drawn, we put a special termination. So when we say prakriti here means to rationally, that is to circumscribingly, close an area and produce a very large object. So, therefore, pure consciousness has, for its first determination, an object inside itself. And everything else that we consider in any way, other than pure consciousness, is a modification of this large sphere of prakriti, which the scholars usually in European books translate quite blindingly as nature. The associations of the word nature in the West are so mixed up with cabbages and cauliflowers that it's exceptionally difficult to imagine the abstract idea that is really being conveyed by this prakriti. So when we look at this word, we must think that what it really means is the first circumscription within the infinite consciousness. It is like a great big ball which is circumscribed and therefore closed in, and it is the supreme object. It is the one meat ball of the popular song. It is the very same food that came out of the eater. The Purusha himself observes, makes this object, and what he makes it from is fundamentally a closing principle that produces a sphere. Now, in Samkhya, this is the root substance of all being of the objective order. And beyond it, there is only pure consciousness. Pure consciousness is absolutely free, and prakriti is entirely law-bound. A substance, cosmic substance is prakriti here, has three phases, and these phases are called gunas, which is a word related to another word that means woman, and this word was chosen because of the phasic behavior of the feminine aspects of being, that is, they change. Now, we can say the forms are three in this way, three modes. Sattva itself, and this word means a balancing process, so that once the original closure is there, there is a balancing of the energies within this cosmic sphere. That is the highest phase of it, a perfectly balanced phase. If you get to that level of balance internally, the next step is that you become pure consciousness. So yoga is aiming to attain this balance. And yoga is the technique of balancing the organism by various techniques to bring it to its highest level of objectivity, beyond which there is only pure consciousness. Now, immediately following this, the balance being disturbed, there is another term used, rajas, which is exactly the same as the English word rage. When you disturb the balance, you start doing something. Now this rajas means to rule, to have the will to dominate the situation. Imagine a great sphere of energy in perfect balance. This energy does not commit itself to any finite thing, any finite aim or object, and therefore it is not bound by an object. But as soon as it begins to commit itself to an object, it intends to rule in that situation. And rage is the natural response of a person who was intending to rule a situation when the situation gets out of hand. So the term rajas is used for this raging intent to dominate phase of universal substance. Now, if you can't get your own way when you try to dominate the situation, after many attempts you go into another stage, and this stage was called tamas, and tamas has the same meaning as tamas, the tummy. It means you can go down into the lower regions and, to use a technical term, glump, because you can't get your own way. So it's quite legitimate to translate tamas as, in the Anglo-Saxon, pure glump. When you're in a perfect state of balance, all is well. You have no ambition, you don't want to go to the pictures, and therefore if somebody says you can't go, you won't be annoyed. When you move into the state of rajas, you do decide to go, and you discover the wife has locked the door and thrown the key away. And your energy then beats violently on the panels, failing to get through, it goes quickly into the back kitchen, thrusts its hand into rice, then gets sand and thrusts its hand into sand, and gets very hard, then goes down, hits it karate style, and goes to the pictures. Now all that is called rajas activity. But if when it goes into the kitchen there is no rice to practice with, then it sits down and goes into pure glump. So these three modes, as they are called, are quite legitimate modes to contemplate that universal substance can be in a state of balance, or it can be in a state of unbalance, rushing towards some objective to do something, or having tried to do it, can be sitting down, glumping. When they translate in the scholar's books, tamas equals darkness, it doesn't really help you very much, unless you understand that there is no darkness other than that caused by glumping. Because really there isn't any darkness in the whole universe other than that produced by a consciousness folding in on itself because it can't get its own way and refusing to bring its ball out and play. So here we have cosmic substance in three phases. These three phases, every being is in some part of itself, in some order of balance. A person can be in a state of balance in relation to one subject. That's, if somebody asks me if I would like to go to a football match, I should be very subtlety, I should be very balanced about it. I should not rage if somebody stops me going. And I should not glump if somebody makes me go. I should take a notebook with me and think about something totally different. This is a matter of personal temperament, of course. Now, when we take these three together, we can always find that any activity that we've got at any moment of life is being dominated by one of these in some part of our being. We can actually be smiling at one level, called fatuous euphoria, cursing like mad and breaking everything, at the same time, whilst being terribly miserable because the things we have broken, we have discovered were our own. So that we can, in different parts of our being, simultaneously operate in these three ways. So here we are with the cosmic substance. We'll draw a little line now. We have the three phases of cosmic substance. The tendency is, of course, always to go down, and everything whatever that is appearing within the cosmos has these three phases always co-present in its being and always operative at some level simultaneously. Yoga aims to try to get rid of the tamas around us and go into the sattva in order to become the pure consciousness again. Now, the first evolute of Prakriti, which is called Mother Nature, if you think of Mother Nature, meaning as a great sphere of substance, its first evolute with these three phases in it is the 26 category that shouldn't be there, And it is quite simply called the Great Mahat. You all know Mahatma Gandhi, don't you? He was a great spirit. Mahat means the great, but it is a term used, so we'll have to, I should have done this diagram upside down and wound it the other way, of course. This Mahat, great, simply means the vibrations of the cosmic substance in its three phases simultaneously co-presented, and is cosmic intellect. In Christianity it is called the Logos, the supreme universal reason. But it is said that the first evolute of this root substance is intellect, which is buddhi. Now buddhi is really the maha or universal reason precipitated into an individual. So that when a man is using his intellect, he is actually using a universal function. This is why if you say 2 and 2 are 4 and you understand what you mean by it, if you say a triangle has 3 sides by definition of tri and angle, then you are actually using this cosmic reason although you are an individual. And when you are using this cosmic reason although you are an individual, what you are using is called buddhi. Now buddhi means that cosmic reason is operative in the individual as intellect. I'm going to change this diagram a little bit to explain what happens. I'm now going to draw a small circle and write the name of it around the edge this time, so that we remember we are actually working inside. Now the horizontal line I drew before, and everything below it, is now represented by this circle, and below now means inside the circle. So that when we talk about, in Genesis, waters below the firmament, we are talking about substance inside the circle. Here is the root substance of the universe as one great sphere. And inside this, there is an evolute, which I'll represent by 2 triangles. And these 2 triangles, which are the pair that appear on the Israeli flag, are the symbol of universal intellect. But when we come to consider them inside an individual man, they are still universal, because it is always and forever true that triangles have 3 sides. It is not a private reason. It is a reason shared by everybody. Everybody agrees that triangles have 3 sides and squares have 4. And therefore we use the symbol of the double triangle, making a 6-pointed star, to represent cosmic reason, logos, which in the individual man is called intellect. Now, that intellect, by definition, is no more than the vibratory activity of this cosmic sphere. And when we consider the vibrations of that sphere, the waves sweeping backwards and forwards within that sphere, imagine this triangle is condensing and becoming smaller and smaller, and the other one is doing the same. We can see that we must have inside this big circle a little circle with a double triangle inside it. In fact, we can have any number of those little circles with double triangles inside, all produced by the expansion-contraction process of universal substance. And wherever such a structure appears, that is called the intellect, the buddhi of the individual man. So that when a man suddenly comprehends that a triangle has 3 sides, and why it does, because tri means 3, then he is being intellectual. I said to a little girl today, and she was explaining to me the things I had forgotten about triangles, and she told me that the triangle had 3 sides. And I said, why? And she looked very serious and then said, really, it's a straight line twice bent and the ends put together. Now that was an intellectual judgment of the highest order, out of which she was able to prove that the angles inside that triangle must add up to 180 degrees. Now that was cosmic reason functioning in an individual. She said she'd never been asked why before about triangles, but this reply came in. At that moment, when she opened herself, the solution was presented. She had at that moment been on the plane of cosmic reason while she was still in an individual body. So she was at that moment exactly identical with Gautama Buddha in relation to that one thing. The savior of the world, according to the Hindu rebellious spirit called Gautama, who founded Buddhism, was a man who attained that level and saw that same geometrical truth in the same way. That little girl saw it. She was on the same level. If she had stayed on that level all day, very strongly, probably a pilgrimage would have started in the direction of the house where she lived. So it's probably a good job that she didn't. For the time being, anyway. But it's well known that lady yogis are characterized in a way slightly different from gentlemen yogis. Now, when we look at this diagram, we realize we can draw a circle anywhere and construct within it the double triangle symbolizing the intellect. And this is true because the pure consciousness is a continuum. And it is this pure consciousness that is precipitating these forms within itself from itself. So it is inherently a self-illuminating consciousness. This is essential for any kind of therapy or self-development, that it shall be realized that everybody is already internally absolutely omniscient, and that yoga is the process whereby you move backwards from object identification through to the source from which you came. I'm going to start this drawing again, slightly more simplified. There's our circle, here's our double triangle to symbolize the intellect. And this now represents a little circle within the big circle, and is therefore an individual man. Now, this intellect will always say, as Socrates remarked, the same thing about the same thing, which most young Greeks of his day found very boring. If somebody said, what is a triangle, and Socrates said, a three-sided figure, some young blood would say, you said that yesterday. To which he replied, I always will, about triangles. This was considered very boring at the time. Nevertheless, it's true, of course. And something like eternal truths are very boring. Now, within this six-sided figure at the center, you can see that there is another closure occurring, because the vibrations that split the sphere in this way, as we've represented it with the double triangles, are producing, by their overlapping, another shape, a hexagon. And this hexagon itself, in its vibrations, is producing another form. Now, the form that we write inside here has a five-pointed star. We are putting there for a specific reason, which we can ontologically justify. When within the intellect of a being, from any point of view within the infinite, it can be stated by any circle, I have a legitimate point of view. If this circle here on the right looks at this angle, it can say, to me it looks like this, but this fellow looking at the same angle from outside will draw it in a different way. So one will say, to me it looks like this, and the other fellow will say, to me it looks like this. Now both are right from their own points of view, And within the universal arises all the individuals, and within each individual arises a proliferation of points of view, all legitimate. This is why it is never right to correct from the outside another person's legitimate viewpoint. Because this is so, that there is this point of view, every little circle we draw is an individual. And therefore, Samkhya says, after the buddhi has been produced, that is, after this intellect has been produced, the next evolute is the individual sense of existence. So we're going to write quickly up here, Purusha, this pure consciousness, and we're going to write the Prakriti, or cosmic substance. In very little letters, we're going to write the 26 that isn't there, which is universal form or logic. And then below this, we're going to write the buddhi, which is the intellect of the universe reflected in man. And then from this, because it recognizes the legitimacy of individual point of view, there emerges from the buddhi another one, ahamkara, which is the same kara that was in the Prakriti. But now it says, I am created, or literally, that which makes the I. This is your sense that you are an individual in your own right, and that there is an intellectual justification for being an individual, because the cosmic reason has stated very clearly that there is a legitimate viewpoint from every point that can be established. And this creates the sense, I am, aham. So we have then, as a natural evolution of the intellect, the sense, I am an individual. Now, from this individual sense springs out some very fine elements, tanmatras, which are simply extensions of the sense of I vibrating to emerge, to say, if I have a point of view legitimately according to reason, then I am now going to develop legitimately through my center of observation. So from this sense of egoism appear some elements which constitute the mind, and the word here is manas. And this word, which is translated mind, must not be confused with the buddhi, which is the intellect, because the intellect only says all triangles have three sides, all squares have four sides. It does not say, and your Aunt Florence is entitled to own them all. That is a private judgment. It merely says that things are formally, universally, what they are. But the manas itself is what we mean in Europe by mind. It is made from a word meaning to measure, to count, mensuration. The word man is borrowed from the same root. Man is a being who counts, and by counting creates a sense of value. But this is an evolute of the sense of existence as a finite individual. In other words, the mind, the manas, as opposed to your pure intellect, is born out of egoism. So that everybody has a mind that functions as a private evaluating mechanism, and this private evaluating mechanism sets itself over against the rest of the universe as a valid point of view, and then proceeds to think that because it is a valid point of view, it is possible to impose its point of view on the rest of the universe. This is called the form. When you begin to think that because you have a point of view, it is legitimate to hammer everybody on the head with that point of view and subordinate them to that point of view and forget that their point of view is legitimate also, from the moment you do that, you have undergone what is called the form in religious terminology. fall into objectivity, objective pursuit of finite dominions and power. Now the manas itself is the mind, and from the mind come the five sense organs inside the brain, and from these are projected forth the five external sense organs that you can see, like eyeballs and so on. If we add these things up, we can count five external physical objects, the things we can see, smell, taste, touch, hear, and so on. Five external sense organs that look at those things. Five orders of objects in the mind called ideas, ideas of things seen, tasted, touched, smelled, and heard. And five internal brain centers corresponding with the external organs. Twice five are 10, and twice 10 are 20. And we then say we've got these five, and here 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And the Mahat is the 26. So when it says the 25 categories, it is really saying that Prakriti and Mahat are synonyms viewed from a certain point of view. Now let's look at this in a slightly different way to simplify it. We use the glyph of Christianity, which people sometimes mispronounce when they say Xmas for Christmas. This is a Greek letter P that we call an X, and we can use this, and it was anciently used for this purpose, in a very simple and helpful way. We can imagine that up here is pure consciousness, and down here is a closed triangle of matter. So we have here a triangle of substance, or as in the West they would refer to it as matter. It has three sides to symbolize the three phases of being balanced, raging for something you want, or being miserable because you can't get it. So the triangle in the material world symbolizes then the three phases. Happy because you don't want anything, raging because you do, and miserable because you can't get it. And these are the three sides of the triangle. We can call that the terrestrial triangle if we like, or any other term, meaning the sphere of mass inertia, of defined heavy inert substances, which are closed. But the triangle above it, we won't draw a line on the top, because there shouldn't be one there. But we will draw a line, not quite at the top, because we want to represent that not at the top, but somewhere, and this triangle is reflected here, and this is the line again on the cosmic sphere of substance, Prakriti. And immediately below that, which is the Mahat level, is the intellect or buddhi of the individual man. And then that buddhi is shining down here, and right on the point of the intersection is the ego structure. So we can write that word there and indicate what it is. Now everything that is in pure consciousness is now focused down from the infinite through the finited sense produced by intellect. Remember, the intellect produces it. The legitimacy of private, individuated point of view. Shining through that point of view, it illuminates dimly a privated world. A world that is legitimately under the dominion of that point. That ego has authority over its own sphere, but it has no authority whatever beyond it. Now there's an interesting word, the word lens, which means a seed and also a thing through which you can focus something. So if we like to represent the ego here in lens shape, seed shape, we can see that it has exactly the same function, the egg yolk has the same function that a lens does in a camera. The infinite possibilities of pure consciousness passing through that lens of egoic individuated awareness focus some of the infinite within a finite sphere under the jurisdiction of the owner of the lens. Now we can see that as above ego there is the intellect, which is really the cosmic reason focusing in the individual, and below that ego we have a mind with five senses, then we have five inner senses and five inner objects called ideas, five outer senses and five orders of stimuli in the material world. Now this is the structure from which all yoga starts. We start at the bottom end, we have a physical body. We examine the physical body by hitting it in various ways, and we find certain parts of it are more sensitive than others, and these we find in their highest degree of sensitivity as centers, and we call them sense organs. If I poke my eye, it's a bit tender. It's more tender than if I poke another part of my body not specialized in this way. Wherever there is a nerve ending specialized to receive a stimulus, we have a kind of sensitivity that we do not find in other parts of the body. So if we start with the physical body, we find that there are zones of extra sensitivity in it, and these we call the external sense organs. Some are spread over the whole body, more or less, like the sense of touch, although even that is not absolute, and some are localized, like the visual sense in the eye or the ear, and so on. Now, we can see in examining this body with its senses that it is in a very unenviable position, because the consciousness identified with it is confined to observations he can make through those finite sense organs. And we'll show the same thing again. This time we'll do the X this way. And here we'll have the pupil of the eye. There is the eye, and now here is the brain of man. That's funny, man. And just where the pupil is named after the learner on the inside, there is a picture thrown through that into the mind of some external object. So we'll make the outside triangle dark to represent the material world. And the way that stimulates this eye throws an image into the mind. So this is the same diagram as the other one, only now turned on its side. As we observe from outside, we discover our senses are orientated, they are turned in a certain way. So my eyes are on the felt of my head, and if I'm watching you and thinking only about you, and some joker creeps carefully around my back and hits me on the back of the head, I discover the deficiency of having finite sense organs pointing in a certain way. In gaining a certain sharpness of focus, I have lost my generalized awareness. If I allow the sharp focus to be my sole source of information of the external world, so the whole of the external world outside this physical body, I must now view as alien to this physical body. It is a potential threat. Now we've said that there are three phases of this substance, from the universal right down through all its developments, and therefore the being inside looking out is in one of those three phases. One is dominating in some part of his being at any moment. And if I put a concept in my mind that I am merely this physical body with its organs of perception, and that you are all other similar bodies, and if I look inside my mind and find one unholy mess there, which is what the mind is, really, and if by analogy I say, and probably the rest of you are in the same boat, and looking out in this manner, I have no reason to trust you. As I look out from my closed physical system and look inside at the very limited data that have come from the outside world, I must really say that if I confine myself to the external information, I don't know much. And what I do know is belonging to the past. It doesn't give me any information about what you're all now thinking. And therefore, I must be on guard against you. Now, this is an essential thing, that as soon as we finite consciousness to the physical organism and perceive through the sense organs other beings outside this physical body, but remember, not outside consciousness. Outside this physical body, I cannot predict what you will do to me. And therefore, if I confine myself in this way, I must be profoundly on guard. Because if your external information from your sense organs is all you know, then you are highly untrustworthy. Because even a thing like a triangle is then merely an empirical proposition. You don't have to trust that there is a universal triangle if you confine yourself merely to your sense organs looking out, because you have not examined all triangles, and the very term itself might be meaningless. And as an empirical being, a being turned outwards through the physical organism, you must base your judgment on statistics. That is, you can only add up what has happened to you and interpret in a certain way. So now we find a peculiar thing about the ego-centered consciousness, that by definition it is essentially distrustful of any being whose source of information is simply that which comes from the external world into its mind. So that all beings who have identified their consciousness with their finite egoic structure are necessarily untrustworthy. You may remember in the New Testament that Christ did a lot of miracles, and he says, on account of these many miracles, people began to believe in him. But on that account, he did not begin to believe in them, for he knew what was in man and withdrew from that place. Now, this is a straight statement where the Logos consciousness in Jesus evaluated people by looking at them and saying, well, that one, that's Nathaniel, he's okay, no guile in him. But this was so remarkable that we don't find this statement made twice in the New Testament. Behold, a true Israelite, in whom there is no guile. And this was staggering. He didn't say it before, and he didn't say it again. But whenever he was in a tight corner, he withdrew from that place. Because he knew that if consciousness identifies itself with the egoic centered organism, it has no information available to it other than that which comes to it from the outside world, and it can only evaluate the world in terms of available information, and therefore it must distrust the world. And if it distrusts the world, it must be afraid of the world. And if it's afraid of the world, it must defend itself. And if it defends itself, it must attack. And this is a logical development if you become egoically centered in this way. And once this has been thoroughly realized, that to be egoically determined is to be afraid, to be self-defensive, and to attack, and the utter stupidity of this as a relating basis, then the universal intellect, or supreme yogi, look at it how you will, filtering through said to the ego, well, you've learned the hard lesson that there aren't any trustworthy beings identified with the ego self. It is now time to turn round and come back. That is to say that instead of rushing madly out of your eyeballs when you see something, instead of letting your energy jump out when you see something very charming, so that you quite forget that you've actually got an insight to your skull with control structures inside it, but you tumble out of your skin to an interesting thing, instead of doing that, turn back and go inside and let's look for the origin of value. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Value is in the eye of the beholder. Now, shortly, Samkhya says quite simply, the origination of all things is in pure consciousness. Pure consciousness precipitates from itself by catalytic action, simply by consciousness as power, precipitates the supreme object, which is the universal substance, modifies this object modifies within consciousness in three phases: a balanced calm phase, a raging desireful phase, and an inert miserable phase. And when these are balanced in a certain way, they appear within the individual as the mind, sense organs, and by progressive compaction become the actual material objects, because the material world is simply a condensation of the fine elements, the tanmatras, which are precipitated through the mind from the egoic center. This means that every material object in the universe is really a precipitate of pure consciousness focused to individual lenses to produce the so-called time material world. Now, yoga says the way back is very, very simple. All you have to do is stop all this mucking about of egoic self-defense. It's quite simple. Realize that two wrongs don't make a white, as Mao said, and proceed to dare to function again as pure consciousness. Now, this requires a terrible lot of courage, because you know very well that nobody else is doing it, and that all egoic beings want your blood because they're terrified of you. But your supreme logic, which is now infiltrated too, if you've been a proper prodigal, tells you you have no alternative but now to turn back. But you must go the whole hog in being egotistic before you can turn back. But the more sharply you push your logic, the more quickly you realize that egotism is privation, deprivation, as well as privacy. Then you can turn back. Now, aphorism one is a very simple one. It says, yoga is the suppression of all rubbish. It's quite a simple thing, really. All you have to do is stop doing silly things, willing silly things, feeling silly things, thinking silly things. That's all. Get rid of the rubbish. Now, they have a special word for this rubbish. An interesting word. Now, this word, vritti, which is a plural, of course, literally means a whirlpool. Because when consciousness focuses inside itself, the power of consciousness begins to spin. And this spin, in its first form, is a universal idea, and its next form is condensed to become an egoic center, and then within that, it makes the fine structures we call the inner sense organs, and within each one of those, it creates the precipitating of those fine into gross. It makes the gross material organs, and thus precipitates the whole material world progressively inside itself. And yet it is all quite simply whirlpools. Whirlpools of consciousness. Now, you make a whirlpool of consciousness whenever you focus your consciousness on anything whatever. So yoga is a very simple thing. Religion is a simple thing. Don't focus your consciousness on a thing, no whirlpool will arise, and then you will see everything. That's what Christ called, if you are prepared to lose your egoic life, you will find it, it will still be there, as one of an infinity of other lives. But now you will be pure consciousness, and you will see these as all equally valid. And you will gain it, because it will still be there, but you will have added to it the percepts of all the others, because now you are identified with pure consciousness. Now, that is the theoretical basis of yoga, that the material world itself is a precipitate of a mental world, which is a precipitate of an egoic center, which is a precipitate of cosmic intellect, which is the first evolute of cosmic substance, which is that which arises in pure consciousness when it focuses. So if we want to escape all the rubbish of the material, temporal, spatial world, all we have to do is move backwards to pure consciousness. In terms of technique, it means you turn your consciousness backwards from the object, turn it inside and say I to yourself, and then carry the I backwards to say am consciousness. And you see then yourself as consciousness, and you see that there is no importance whatever in the external object other than that which you decide to put upon it. If you put none on, there is none for you. If you put some on, there is some for you, even if another being puts none on that which you think is important. Important means you are importing, in carrying your consciousness into an object. And there is no other bondage or slavery in the whole universe or any other universe other than this. The focus of consciousness onto a center which it has chosen arbitrarily in itself, the piling in of energy producing a spin, the spin making an object, the object now being served by the consciousness, trapping the consciousness in the service. The Greeks had a simple little story of this about a clever sculptor who was so pleased with his own powers of sculpting that he made himself an idol, and it was so lovely he fell down and worshipped it, and he never made another one. Now that is the Greek view of egotism. It's also the story of Narcissus. The only excuse for Narcissus really is that the girl that was chasing him was Echo, and she always had the last word. Now, we've seen the theoretical basis of yoga. Now we'll see what it says. How did you say that? My mechanic did that. We'll see what it says about practice. Now, I won't bother about the technical terms at all this time, because we can do that. It says, because the external physical world is nothing but a precipitation of consciousness onto centers, and because there are an infinity of such centers, therefore the only thing to do to avoid being imposed on from any given center by an infinity of other centers is quite simply withdraw from the identification. Now the first stage, therefore, in yoga practice, after you've sworn yourself in on the oath of ahimsa, which means absolute harmlessness to all beings, because you recognize that they're fundamentally only modifications of yourself, which is pure consciousness, having sworn yourself into pure harmlessness, your next step is withdrawal from the sense organs. That is, instead of allowing your senses to leap out every time they see a pretty something or other, a desirable trinket in the window, instead of allowing them to leap out, you pull them back. And you allow the object to come to you. You take your sense organs back inside. You can look at an object, but you don't let yourself jump to get it. You then take the thing inside. You withdraw the attention. Tension is energy focused in the part of an organ. Now, when you focus in a sense organ like the eye, you begin to see things. Pull the energy backwards in the mind, and the same with hearing, smelling, tasting, and so on, until you have drawn your five senses inside. Now, when you are inside, you are now at a higher level than you were when you were focused on an external object. And you are on the way to freedom. You have taken your sense organs and drawn them in. Now after that, the next phase is concentration. Concentration is when, having turned yourself inside, you select inside, because you know that in principle there is nothing outside that is not already inside, because your internal triangle is an exact reflex of the external and the external of the internal. You know that when you turn inside, you can select, even if empirically only from your memory, some particular thing or idea photographed in your mind. So supposing I take a triangle again. I have never seen a perfect triangle outside, but I've seen approximations to them on drawing boards. And I've turned my attention inside, and I now have in my mind an idea of a triangle. Actually, in this case, this triangle is precipitated up here in my mind. I'm now looking at this triangle. In my mind, I have withdrawn from the sense organs. I'm now concentrating on the triangle, and I begin to perceive in the triangle certain qualities. Now, at this point, I must be concerned entirely with looking at the triangle, not with importing significances into it that I think should be there, derived from my external education. But I must let the triangle act within me as a triangle. Let it be its own boss, and let it tell me what it knows about itself. I focus on it, and this is concentration. Now I begin to meditate. First withdrawal, then concentration, then meditation. In meditation, I discursively reason about the triangle. That is to say, I look at the triangle, and then I say something about the triangle that relates the triangle to something else. And then I come back to the triangle. So if I see a triangle, and I'm now looking at the triangle and striking circles from each point, vertex of an angle, all rounded, I'm now seeing a complex structure, and I rub them out again and restate the triangle. Discursive reasoning is meditation. I say something about the relation of the angles. And if I push the triangle mentally one way, and the angle increases on one side and diminishes on the other, and so on. All this is discursive reason, which is called meditation. Now, if I do this till I've completely exhausted what I can say about the triangle by looking at it inside my mind, so that I've got nothing else to say about it, I now retain the triangle and all the things I have said about it in toto. And this is called contemplation. Contemplation means going up and down in the same time. In other words, being in phase. It is determining my inner state. This is withdrawal from the sense organs, concentration upon some internal object, an idea, discursive reasoning or meditation, and when that is completed, contemplation, hold the whole thing and let it tell me. Now, to do this, we must believe that it has something to say. And we must know that this belief is justified because universal force operates in a geometrical manner and has precipitated this triangle inside my being. Now, if I do these three things together, after the withdrawal, I concentrate, discursively reason or meditate, contemplate, hold the total result in my mind. Those three together are called samyama, which literally means the seed is dead. That is to say, it can no longer operate on me, but I can operate on it. A certain lady Theosophist was rather alarmed at one point by this word, because she said, well, you see, you want to be careful of it, because that word means death, yama. And of course, really, death means the affirmation of the material activity. It means identification. But Sam is the same as seed, like the modern German Same. Seed, same. So it means to kill the seed. If you concentrate upon an object and see all its possibilities, meditatively surveying it, going round it, finding out all about it, and then contemplate the totality of it, you have gained by that threefold activity power over the object. This is the power you'll have to give up later, of course. But first, you get it. So if you were to say man is a three-part being, that is, he thinks, he feels, he has volitions, and these three parts are in association with the physical body, and whenever there is a living physical body, there are three processes, a volitional, affective, and ideational process, and therefore I have three possibilities with a living human being of stimulating that being in such a way that if he doesn't know the rules, because to every action there's an equal and opposite reaction, if I give him a volitional stimulus, there'll be a volitional response. If I give an affective stimulus, there'll be an affective response. If I give an ideational stimulus, there'll be an ideational response. And if I give the three simultaneously and he doesn't know the rules, then he will not be in charge of the behavior of that organism. Now this is the power that Patanjali points out comes inevitably when you do samyama, that is to say when you concentrate, discursively meditate and contemplate any object whatever, that object speaking inside you in your own psyche will tell you exactly what makes it tick. And with this knowledge which you gain, you have increased your power of balancing sattvic response, or annoying people, rajasic response, or depressing people. Because if you do this and they don't, you know more about their organism than they do, and if you know more about it than they do, you have the whip hand. You can stimulate them in three ways. You can make the miserable delighted, you can make the delighted annoyed, you can make the annoyed miserable. You can go to all the permutations on these things. And until a person knows himself in this full manner, in this structure of being, until he knows himself throughout all his various levels, he is at the mercy of the stimulus that hits him on any of those levels. So we see that yoga was originally devised as a method from the three end, from pure consciousness, to filter through into the material world, to give objective education of what it means to be in private bondage, and then lead back the identified consciousness into pure consciousness again, so that it has completed a process of involution into the material body and evolution back to pure consciousness. So that when we make this sign, which is the sign of Taurus in the zodiac, we have really represented the whole thing. There's a giraffe trying to see that, so I'll do it again. When we do this, we're given a very short grip of the whole process. Over there is pure consciousness. It vectors itself down, makes this cosmic sphere of substance, comes inside, and wherever it rotates, it makes an individual, and so doing. And then it climbs out again and returns to pure consciousness. That is the whole process in one symbol. With the aid of the structure given in Samkhya philosophy and the observed fact that these things are so, we do have physical bodies separated from other physical bodies. These physical bodies do have five external sense organs. These do convey stimuli internally to corresponding centers in the mind. These have their objects, namely ideas. All these are carried inwards to the center of the mind, which is egoism. This itself is a legitimate point of view postulated by reason, the intellect, and this itself is a precipitate of cosmic reason into the individual. And this cosmic reason itself is the formal aspect of universal substance, which is itself the supreme self-observation of pure consciousness.